Good. I go back and forth in this class because the details on one hand are unimportant, right? The actual geeky, like what's in this box kind of thing, doesn't matter. They work. We know that they work. We're not going to work on them, right? And at the same time, getting enough of the details to be able to get back up to the layer of abstraction, I think, is the key goal of the class, right? You want to be able to think about the two networks we happen to be comparing today in enough detail, the phone network and the internet, to start both looking at, oh, okay, the IP, you know, the IP address space is four cats or whatever, and have that mean something to you about designing or observing networks generally. So I go back. So I'm gonna dig into a little bit of detail now, having some conversations on the break that suggest that we do a little bit, kind of a recap of that, how to data transfer across the network. Again, with the understanding that I'm using the box illustration, but it doesn't matter. It's the principle again. So this is a router. One line plugs in here. This is all the incoming traffic. Here goes through the router. And it's got four ports. Right? So how many addresses can this box manage?
Four.
It can manage four addresses. And the decision this box needs to make, Evan, is which of the four addresses that I just got the message from does this go to? Or when it came from any of these four addresses, how do I hand it off?
It's one of those go to.
Okay. we're gonna not pay attention to DHCP for a minute. We're gonna play like these are hard coded addresses. DHCP is a way of making addresses dynamic, which we'll talk about probably another class. But so the decision here is 1 to 4. If I want one router for the whole internet, I have one incoming line and 4 billion outgoing lines, right? That's a big problem. Even Cisco couldn't make a box. So the really radical thing that the network did is it decoupled the decision making so that it doesn't have to be built to the address, doesn't have to be the router. And so the intelligence in this box, and this is what I mean by this being a dumb network, the intelligence of this box is simply which one of the four buckets does this go into? Right. The message came in here, I've got to send it to 1, 2, 3, or 4. Right. And that's all I have to do. And to underline this, the edges are the same thing as the middle. One of the things that goes off of this box could be another router, which could be another router. Right? There's a theoretical infinite number of routers I could chain together and still have a message arrive. Now, in practice, I don't need an infinite number. I need less than 30 hops worth to cover the globe. I put up on the screen a trace route. A trace route simply says, tell me how a message is getting from point A to point B. Right? So I trace from this box, from the box that I'm just sitting at, to, that's interesting. This version of trace route has now got time to live at 64 hops. So you can get pretty deep in the network congestion. You can see that first line there. It used to be 30 hops. 30 hops is still the norm for message loader. So it goes to something called Broadway Gateway for the net at NYU. And you can see that that's on our Class C subnet. Right? This box is 128.122.151.something. It goes to the gateway, which is .1. That's by convention. Most gateways are .1, but it's not hard-coded. The next hop number 2, it goes to the core gateway. Then it goes to NYU Gateway A. Then it goes to external gateway on the VLAN. And then all of a sudden, we're out on the open internet. And you can see what happens here. We've switched to IP addresses being... This is actually quite rare. Step 6, you can see that already the message is taking two different routes. A trace route actually makes several different attempts to send a message to see how variable the network traffic is. Usually they work out exactly the same because the routing tables are pretty stable, but you can see that in step six, two different points on step six, it went to two different IP addresses, 216.140.10, 221, and 10.13. And then you can see, actually, the next hop went to two different addresses as well, 117.121. So already, just in probing the route between here and Yahoo, we've got some variability in routes, which we could not, by definition, have in the phone network. Then it's going over an IP provider called Broadwing. It goes from New York to Washington. Then it goes to Gateway 2-6. And then it goes into Yahoo's network and is on its way to Yahoo.com, the main site. So that down at the level of the geek unit handles what it looks like. I want to emphasize only that each of those machines is only responsible for getting it closer. Each of the machines in that collection of 12 hops simply took the message in and said, my job is to get this closer to what I think to the IP address listed there at the top, but not, in fact, to deliver it all the way. So,
How does net.nyu.edu know where to deliver the messages outside the network?
Well, when you go to the bot, first of all, NYU is optimized for routing messages within the campus. So it has to go through a couple of hops there until it gets from nyu.edu to nyu.net. And you can see external gateway. So external gateway, when it's handed off from the gateway out of Tisch, when NYU Central gets to it, it says, this is not an address that I manage. Right? This is outside here. So we're going to take it to the external gateway. It's exactly analogous to our three-ring network of it's local, it's local. So the external gateway says it's global, hand it off to our IP provider, and that is Broadwing. I didn't know that. That's evidently who we buy. And Broadwing has a New York network. You can see it gets across the country in two hops from New York to DC. Right. So this is again, geography is not topology. Right. There are four hops within NYU, and three hops from the basement of ITS to Washington State. Right. So it has nothing to do with geographic distance and everything to do with points of decision.
So is there should be some sort of, it should be intelligent enough to know where to have the packet, right?
It has to be intelligent enough to know how to get the packet closer. Right. And in the early case, right, between step four and five there, that decision was, I'm going to hand it off to somebody who knows better than me what the outside world looks like, because NYU has almost no idea what the outside world.
So every router stores some information about where it should hand off a particular packet.
That's right. But no router stores global information. So, and routers typically know either, yes, this is a full IP address I manage, I'm going to hand it directly to the computer, or I'm going to get it out of my network and off to somebody who can make a better decision than I.
But how do they know that it needs to go to Washington, which is closer to the West Coast, which may be where Yahoo is?
Well, who's the they in that sentence?
The router.
Okay, so... when external gateway hands it off to Broadwing, all external gateway knows is, I don't manage this, I'm going to hand it off to Broadwing.
Okay.
Broadwing then says, all right, this is 216.109, and you can see that Broadwing is then, first thing Broadwing does is it gets it onto the 216 class A address. Right? So you can see where it goes from 67 to 216. So already, we've cut down by 256 the total size of the address space. So now we're dealing with, you know, 0.5% of the total address space after it goes to 216. And you can see that it stays in 216 for the rest of the message. Right? So then, once I've got it in 216, I can say, well, it's got to go to 109. Right? So it goes, and that's where the routing table comes in. The routing table says, if I want to get it to 109, I'm going to get it to this other router. It has no concept that the router is in Washington. It just says, this IP address is closer to the final delivery than I. In fact,
could you do a trace route just in Google and see how that works out?
Especially when you want to hit the up arrow twice. And it's look up google.com.
Expensive.
Sorry.
Do you have to type in?
Yeah. So just erase and type in google.com. And then tracer at dollar sign exclamation mark.
Oh, no, that will work.
Yeah, well, tracer at look that up. Tracer at dollar sign exclamation mark. Space dollar sign exclamation mark. All right. Trace route. Two space 216 dot 239 dot 216 dot 239 dot 57 dot 99. You can see it goes through the same process in NYU. It's identical, right? I don't know where this is. They're going to hand it off to Broadwing. Broadwing takes it across the country to Washington. It drops down, and then it gets handed off to. It goes out of the 216 namespace to 66 dot something, and you can see all of those last IP addresses are absolutely raw. There's no domain type. Those are probably Google's. Google maintains a huge internal network. This brings up a point that we made a little bit last week. But we've been using the word name and address interchangeably. That's because they're the same thing, right? An address is a unique identifier within a network. A name is just an alias for an address, right? So Google.com is a unique name. It is also tied to, what did we say, 216, 239? It's also tied to that IP address. So a name is really just the readable component of an address. And in fact, once you can do that, you can do lots of things with it. You can have addresses without names, as here. Google has not named any of its, doesn't have a DNS entry for many of its IP addresses. right? I can also do things like taking some grody URL and running it through tinyurl.com. Right? So I got a tiny URL. Have you seen these things, the URL shorteners? Right? So let's say I wanted to alias google.com or something, and I got...
ABCD.
What is that name pointing to? When I run a tiny URL, what is the tiny URL name pointing to? No, not yet.
The ABCD like thingies for four chunks of.
No, actually, I should have done ABCD. Let me do. 1, 2, 3, 7. There's nothing.
Okay.
Those are just
that's in fact unique namespace within time URL like now. What does time URL point to?
It's
what's it an alias for?
Yeah. For the target address.
Right. So now you can see we've got an unlimited number of redirects. A tiny URL is an alias for a domain name, which is an alias for an IP address. Tiny URL does not look up IP address. And I could do this chain forever. And I could do, I don't know if you've seen make a huge URL. Right. As a joke, right? If you want to look like you've got some really expensive content management system, right? You can run a regular URL through it, and give you this one of those ginormous things that you can never read the whole thing on the command line. Right? So I could take the tiny URL and I could run that through make a huge URL, right? And on and on and on and on. And every step would just dereference until it gets down to google.com, at which point it would finally leave the domain name system and start pointing to the IP address. Right? So you can do it in a chain. You can also do, right, we've kept the name stage for backwards compatibility, but both of those point to the same IP address. Both of those point to the same IP address. So names can go in parallel or serial. They can be aliases for one another. And at some point, you leave one namespace and you enter the other. But what I want to emphasize about that and about this drawing is both domain names and IP addresses are namespaces. They both have the characteristics of uniqueness. Namespaces map to IP addresses, but they are not the same namespace. One name can map
to another name, have some sort of internal lookup for mapping to another name. Two names can map to one IP address. But one thing that can't happen is that one name can't map to two IP addresses.
So they're parallel namespaces that perform different functions. The number is the name of the machine, and the name is the name of the number. And the name exists only for as syntactic sugar. Right? This is just to help humans. As you can see from the middle of that particular tracer, it's utterly inconsequential to the machines. The first thing a machine wants to do is get rid of the human readable stuff and go down to the numbers where it's more.
So, model one for this class is all models are wrong, some models are useful. The second motto for this class is every solution creates new problems. So we can now get a packet of data across the internet in a way that where we don't have to hard code the route and we don't get any of these kind of meltdown problems. Good for us. What happens when you want to send more than a packet of data, which say more than about 56 bytes, right? As Sean mentioned earlier, the internet by convention is drawn as a cloud. The connections are too complicated and they're too variable. There is never any point, no one has ever taken a picture of the internet past about 1983 because you never know, you can never accurately map all the connections because the time of mapping goes from one end to the other, something has changed in the middle. Right? So unlike the phone network, which you can map, this is even in theory unknowable. But I can nevertheless pop a message in one side and get a message out the other side. By message, I mean a datagram. What problem have I now got? And I shouldn't draw this as a letter, actually, because that makes it seem more like it's email. What we're really talking about is
sending packets.
I can get a byte in. And I can get the same byte out. And I can do that for up to 56 bytes at a time. By the time you're typing the 57th character of your email, what's the problem?
But you have to split up.
You have to split it up. Because this is a packet, and it's a packet switch network. But you don't care about packets. You care about things like web pages and email. So there's some level of abstraction that has to go on between those. What problem did we have with the phone system when we wanted to talk to the phone system about the number? Right. This is an international number. Or now I need to break out of the NYU PBX. And that, to a first approximation, is how everything above this level works. So several people have asked me about email. Either mentioned email or asked questions about sending email. And I deflected those questions because we were still talking before the break of the level of the datagram. Here's how email works. Right. I write my email to whom it may, and so forth. Right. Now I've got to package that up as a message that the network knows about. So here's the body of the email, but I've got to add a little header that says this is an email message. The header is by convention called the SMTP, or by fiat called the SMTP, the Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. You don't need to know that, but that's what. And that's the thing that says anything that's in the form non-space characters followed by a colon followed by a space is a header to space something, from space something, subject space something. And you may see in some of your email headers that look like X dash. The X headers are so that you don't have to determine all the headers in advance. You can invent any headers you like. Right? But the internet doesn't know about email. The internet only knows about packets, so we've got to bridge the gap here somehow. Right. Now, if I write you email that's large enough that it's going to take 68 packets to get to you, what things are you concerned about when you get those packets?
Putting them back in the right order.
Got to put it back in the right order, and what else? Did I get all of them, and did I put them back in the right order?
And we've got to build that on top of packets. So now the whole email, including the SMTP headers, goes into something called TCP,
which is the transmission control protocol. You'll often see TCP IP talked about together as if they were the same thing, in fact, distinct. TCP is responsible for two things. Here are how many packets are in this message, so that you can count. And if I say I'm sending 68, you've got 68, you've got the whole thing. And I'm going to label each one of them, right, so that if you order them up 1 to 68, you can read the message, and if you get them out of order, you won't be able to read the message. If the receiving application gets a message and says, well, I'm missing number 17, it calls across the network, and because it knows the address of the sending host, because that is included in the that's included in the message, it says, send me number 17 again. And I'm going to take that out of order, and I'm going to reintegrate. As we can see from this trace route here, or the previous one, where on step 6 it went through two different routes, the messages can actually go across the network in completely different ways, as long as they still get to the receiving host. And it's up to the receiving host, the intelligence is at the edges, to then count and order the messages. So TCP is about number and order. Underneath TCP, right, so here's the whole message. It gets broken up into datagrams. This is where it gets packetized. And every packet has an IP address. So this is why you often hear people talking about TCP IP. These things seem to go together. Lots of applications use them. Anything that has is stream-based, or rather, anything that where the getting all of the messages and ordering them correctly is important uses TCP. That's most, but not all applications will see that. It gets broken up into IP datagrams. And then beneath the level of the IP datagrams, the packets, right, is this big question mark. Because somewhere down there, there's a physical network. There's wires, there's glass, there's satellite, there's something that's carrying these IP datagrams. And probably the most important fact about the IP datagram, other than the uniqueness, is it can be frame relay, it can be Ethernet, it can be ATM, asynchronous transfer mode, not the bank machines. There's lots and lots and lots of networking tools for moving messages from hither to yon. When you're writing your email, you do not have to know or care. Right? It's going to move over Ethernet locally, then it's going to move onto a fiber optic network that's raw IP. Maybe it'll go through the air on Wi-Fi. Maybe it goes over the phone company's network that's ATM or frame relay at some point. All of that detail is hidden, not just from you, but even from your email application. And one of the things that this can move over is another different IP network. Now, one of the things that an IP network can encapsulate and set on top of is another IP network with a completely different set of address and router. Because the networks can be, as long as you've got this stack, you're okay. And, right, here's you. Here are the machines. Right. Exactly the same way as we talked about our stack earlier. The reason it's drawn this way is that the closer to the people it is, the higher up you draw it, the closer the machine is, the lower down. So this is the way we bridge the gap between I can send one packet. The packet doesn't know when it leaves where it's going. The machines handling the packet aren't responsible for delivering it, ultimately just getting it closer. Right? This is the dumbest, weakest possible way you could build a network. Right? There's no guarantee of delivery with a packet. And yet, somehow, we have to build relatively reliable applications on top of it. This is the strategy. You could do this with FTP. You could do this with HTTP. Every product-oriented, which is to say you look at a web page or an email, internet application is built along these lines. Yes?
By contrast, can you draw what a UDP?
All right, yes.
I don't know if that's appropriate right now.
That's exactly appropriate right now. You guys have a habit of asking a question that's in the middle of the next section. I will move to that. Let me ask first, are there questions about this strategy? About this way of using headers at every step to say, take everything that was done previously and add a little bit of extra information. There is something called the OSI reference model you will sometimes see referred to. It is a 7-layer stack. It delineates everything from the human to the application. I used to teach it in here, and I would have to walk through the OSI stack, which would take about half an hour, and then I would have to end by saying, this is all lies. Because the OSI stack, while everyone refers to it, has never been implemented in any actual network. So instead, I'll just tell you that. Stop teaching. I'll just tell you that. The problem with the OSI stack, if you ever run into it, is it imagines that there is some finite number of layers in a network. But the real answer is there are n layers. And n is at least 4, but it may be many more. For instance, this could be an entire layered network down here. Right? We have no idea, and the internet saves us from having to care. But the internet is the internet, it's not the transnet, it's a connection of networks, but not an overarching one. So there could be a small number of layers, there could be a large number of layers, and anybody who tells you that there's a set number of layers in the network, you know that they're talking about something that's relatively brittle compared to this kind of thing. All right, so real world, we looked at the phone network, we looked at the internet, I made the case that there's important philosophical differences between them. Here's where they're converging. The internet is making the phone network go away. In fact, just as I was, as we get to this point in the class, The Economist comes out, I don't know if you've seen the cover this week, saying the internet is making the phone network go away. It's been happening for some time, but it's accelerating now in financial and business terms, not just in theoretical terms. So who here uses a voice over IP application? Oh, that's interesting. I would have expected it was more.
What is it?
Skype.
Skype or
Yahoo Chat, AIM Chat, anything with voice. Vonage.
Google Talk.
Google Talk. Is it any good?
I didn't test it.
What's that?
It's not.
Oh, it is voice over IP.
I mean, it's voice over IP, but it doesn't attach to the phone lines.
That's a critical distinction. That is, in fact, the critical distinction, which we'll get to in a minute. Yeah, there are. So, voice over IP, right? Marshall McLuhan said famously, so the contents of the new medium is the old medium. In this case, the contents of the packet switch network is becoming the circuit switch. All of what the phone network used to do is now moving to packet switch. Email is what's called asynchronous. All right, which is to say, you and I don't have to be synced for the email to be delivered. In fact, if you are offline, I can still send email to you. It gets cached in a method called store and forward and waits one hop upstream until you reconnect and download. Right. A phone call. Is synchronous, right? You and I have a phone call, we both have to be talking at the same time. Asynchronous applications use TCP. Synchronous applications can't use TCP. Right? TCP actually breaks synchronous applications because if I'm looking at a video stream and I say, wait, I didn't get packet 17, I'm going to wait. Right? If you're watching video, say, it's really important that the sound is coming out at the same time the mouths are moving. Right? There's no time to go back and get a drop packet. And if you're dropping packets, it's probably because there's congestion. If there's congestion, if you have to go back and drop a packet every time, you're going to start stuttering. Right? The video or the audio is going to start stuttering. So synchronous networks use something called UDP. It's a user datagram protocol. And UDP basically says this is the thinnest possible wrapper on a pure IP packet. Just keep sending them. I'll keep catching the ones I can get. A phone call either works and sounds good on the landline. Forget the mobile for a minute. A phone call either works and sounds good or it doesn't work at all. Right? Voice over IP.
No. There's a works and sounds really bad.
Oh, well, that's right. There is static. There is static. That's right. I'm sorry. I should say for local calls. For international, because you're getting repeaters.
Very cool.
that is right. So you do get degradation internationally. With video and with voiceover IP, you can get anything from good quality to really bad quality. But the ability to make the connection doesn't exist in a packet switch network. It exists in a circuit switch network. You either get the circuit or you don't. Here, you're getting some percentage of the circuit, as it were. You're getting some percentage of the packet. So UDP, to answer your question from earlier, is basically the minimum possible wrapper because you don't care about message ordering and you don't care about lost packets. Right? If a message arrives out of order, you're going to throw it away. You're not going to play the tape back and insert it. And if you're not getting some packets, you can't stop and go back because what you're trying to do is stay as in sync with real time as is physically possible. So since 96, people have been working on voice over IP and it's finally gotten good enough for prime. So there's one class of applications. Skype is the avatar of them. They also include Google Chat, or Google Talk rather, the Mac chat program, Amazon Messenger, Yahoo. There was another class of applications. Vonage is the avatar of that class of applications. They have set themselves up as phone companies that happen to offer voice over IP. Given that they both use the internet, given that when somebody is throwing packets across the internet as fast as possible to get synchronized, they're both using UDP. What is the difference between these two companies? Between these two strategies? Forget the companies for a minute. What's the difference between those two strategies? What does Vonage do that Skype doesn't do?
Gives you a bridge between the phone network and the IP network.
So Skype is pure internet. Vonage is Vonage is a bridge between the internet and the phone. Right.
Skype as well.
Yes,
the only thing you have there is just a physical device. Otherwise, it's simply the internet. There's nothing else that's different.
Not quite, because if you're going to bridge these two, what do you have to be able to do? You have to be able to handle
transitions.
But you have to match up thing to an actual phone number.
Right. The problem here is not transferring the messages, which, as you say, can be done with a simple device. It's called an ATA, an analog telephone adapter, that takes looks about like this. Takes Ethernet on one side and the phone plug on the other. Bridging between the two devices is pretty trivial. Bridging between the address spaces is a huge problem. And the big difference between what's the Skype version of this called?
Skype out.
Right. So the big difference between Vonage, Skype out, Packet 7, or Packet 8, and so forth. And Skype, Yahoo Chat, is this does not touch the telephone address space, and this does. And that difference is huge. Why? What's the value of the telephone address space?
You're connecting to a completely different network.
Okay, connecting to a completely different network, but
it's unique.
What's the business value of the phone address space? What's the human value?
It's everyone's convention.
Everybody knows how to use it. It's just ubiquitous.
It's ubiquitous, but it's familiar, right? It is literally the oldest telecommunication network still in existence. People are so mapped to and invested in those numbers, and countries are still so mapped to and invested in those numbers, that turns out that no aspect of the telephone company's engineering right now is good enough to provide any defense against voice over IP. A little bit of economics. When they buried these switches to the ground, and they started really deploying the switches that are in common use today, They financed them with 30-year bonds. They went to their investors and they said, you give us this money and we'll pay you back over 30 years because that's going to be the useful life of the equipment. They did that just as Moore's Law was starting to kick in to be good enough to start moving phone company software into switches. You can now build something that does what a phone switch does for 1/1000th of the cost. Right? 1/10 of 1% of the cost
of those things they bury in the ground.
If every phone company in the world was required to recalculate its books on net present replacement value, they would all be bankrupt tomorrow. Right? The phone company is net in debt if it had to replace itself with voice over IP. And what's slowly happening, in fact, is that the internet is replacing the core of every phone company. Right? The thing the phone companies are in terror of is not actually the loss of their physical equipment, which they are themselves replacing with voice over IP. If you make calls overseas, and particularly to Africa, it is probably going for at least some part of that route over voice over IP already. The thing the phone companies are in terror of losing control of is the address space. That turns out to be the most valuable and defensible asset they have. Because the backwards compatibility with the phone address space is huge. To the point that the FCC has said, if you touch this, you have to offer 911. You have to pay, this is in the States, you have to offer 911 service, you have to pay into the universal service agreements to subsidize rural areas. And if you don't touch this, you're absolutely free to do as you want. The FCC is not going to regulate the Xbox. Right? The FCC is not, at least in its current, I mean, you know, obviously the chairman can change, but in its current configuration, the FCC has said basically, we are adopting a quacks like a duck philosophy. It's not enough to let people talk to be regulated as a phone company. You have to touch this address space. If you do that, you get regulated. If you don't do that, you don't get regulated. So
the 911 depends on the user's reliability because they depend on his Android.
Right. 911, to do 911, since the internet knows nothing about your location, it requires you registering your device at a particular location. But Skype, regular Skype, Yahoo Chat, Xbox doesn't even have to offer that service. And as a result, we're seeing, right, these services that touch this network will probably always cost money. And services that don't will probably always be free. So we're seeing the displacement of voice away from the telephone address space because touching this address space creates enormous expense. And it's we're now in a position to understand why. The address space is actually more valuable than the engineering. But as people get used to Skype, and the thing that terrifies the phone companies is Skype is turning out to have caught on faster than anyone imagined, is that they could lose control of the address space as well. What's the advantage of the Skype address space over the telephone company address space?
You can maintain one number.
It's not a route.
What's that?
It's not a route.
It's not a route. But that's right. That's a generic advantage of internet addressing. But I mean specifically Skype.
It's the same, you have the same address for your internet and your phone.
Right. But what?
It's not tied to a physical address.
It's not tied to a physical address, right? It's portable, it's flexible. But just looking at the two addresses side by side, what's your Skype address? What's your phone number?
It's more personal,
it's more memorable. The death of the phone companies, last year at Burning Man, not this last summer, but two summers ago, they built a Wi-Fi to satellite phone booth. And they said, hey, come in, everybody, come in and make a phone call. We built this funny thing. Nobody could make a phone call because no one could remember anyone's number. Right? They didn't bring their cell phones because it wasn't going to work on the line. And people have stopped remembering 10-digit numbers for their friends because they're just scrolling down the list and clicking send. Right? So being able to reach these devices is great, but in as much as people start moving to Skype, this address space actually always kind of sucked. Right? It was both brittle and non-memorable, and this is neither. So this is the huge shift right now. So these kind of theoretical philosophical things I was drawing, this is going to destroy billions of dollars in market capitalization in the next 2 years. But the differences between these two networks has actually become a really critical source of change in the world. And the change is going around not around the deep engineering, but around the aggressiveness. Yeah,
silly philosophical question. In 9/11, when everything happened and you couldn't actually make phone calls because the network boxes melted, that was a big problem. But you could use internet, right? In the blackout.
Right. Very good.
And because after the blackout, I was going to get rid of my phone. I didn't.
Right.
And I've kept my phone just because of that simple fact that I'm...
Right. The blackout, the internet failed, the phones didn't, because all the routers require power. But as a requirement for the phone company, they run their own generators.
they are off the grid. The phone does not work on the regular electrical grids. The phone company, in addition to or as a consequence of delivering phone calls to your house, delivers a continuous signal of 5 volts. And that's enough to power the ringer. They can spike it to 30 to make the ringer go off. What a lot of people did after the blackout was they ran out to Radio Shack and bought the phone that doesn't have any batteries in it, because everybody's cordless phone died because the batteries in the terminal didn't work. But when I talked earlier about the phone company being five nines because of over-provisioning, right, it has nothing to do with the design of the phone network and everything to do with the design of power management that Mom Bell stayed up while the network went down, because their power supplies don't touch the grid at any point. There's a bunch of people looking at wireless mesh for emergency situations, which would be battery or solar operated. There's actually also some places that are looking at deploying phone networks in third world countries or distressed regions where there is no functioning grid or the grid is unpredictable. And because we've been pushing down to +5 and +12 volts on devices, most of what your power supply does in your computer is it takes 120 and brings it down to something useful, right? The fan is the only thing in there that runs at 120. And it's possible to start making communication networks that are actually permanently or semi-permanently off the power grid. And that fusion will mean that the survivability of 911 in terms of the melting of the switches plus the off-grid is good thing of the blackout can potentially be fused. Yeah, Sean.
Power over Ethernet?
Power over Ethernet, right. The question is, where does the power come from upstream? PoE is a great way to get all hops 2 through N off the grid, but if you're still relying on a generator upstream to get the power over Ethernet into the boxes,
that power can be distributed.
Right. If you do power over Ethernet plus you have a generator in your office, you're good. But it's the upstream decoupling from the grid that really becomes critical for things like power.
Yeah. Do you think when power actually gets to power, I mean, when you can actually power a device like that, do you think that'll really signal the end or really push the end?
The end was signaled in 1969. It's just a waiting game at this point. I mean, it's really. The idea of packet switching is better than the idea of circuit switching. Now, it'll take decades more of implementation. The last party line, right? Imagine party lines are interesting to me. Okay. Imagine, right, you've got that ring network, which is in some ways the dorkiest of all possible network configurations, except that, as I said, there's no network design so bad that someone hasn't built it in the real world. This is how the phone system used to work, right? Except the problem is, our network on day one was packet switch, right? We're just handing these things around. This network is circuit switch, meaning if these two people want to talk to each other, the message goes around here. These people can't because the message is going over their wires, right? So once you've got a circuit switch ring, right, anytime two people are using the network, they're blocking out some other number of participants. The last party line network was decommissioned in Michigan in the end of the 1990s. So it takes a long time for old infrastructure to go away. And really the question about the going away of the phone company is, at what point do you consider it done? If it's when the last phone is detached, call it 2076, right? The 200th anniversary of the phone. That's probably when the last phone will have gone away. If you want to know when 90% of the international backbone is digital, that's already happened. If it's 90% of the international backbone is IP, 2015, 2020, it really, like, depending on where you put your marker, the end point of this transition will be fairly obvious. It'll be different in different countries. There are some countries that want to defend local telco monopolies because they're a good way to get taxes. Phone calls are typically taxed at rates higher than tobacco and alcohol in every country, because they're both addictive and essential, unlike tobacco and alcohol, which are addictive but optional. And when states lose phone tax revenue, it's hard to replace it. So it's going to be a fight country by country. But I'm saying bet on the engineering all the time.
Yeah. Tobacco switching.
What's that?
Tax survival
bonds. Sorry, can you do what? Describe
tax.
It's hard to tax Skype for two reasons. One, there's no revenues. And two, they're not here. So if the SEC wanted to tax them,
They don't have any control over Skype is in Luxembourg.
Right.
So they don't have any right to tax a Luxembourgian country. And when they look at the revenues for this part of Skype, there's no revenues to tax.
But even though Google just bought them, though? Google just bought, I thought Google...
No.
Google
just implemented the Java.
Right. No, Google's implementing Java.
So you can tax revenues where they're tied services in any country, but there's no... You can always tax the phone companies because they have the wires buried in the ground and they're purpose-built.
Right?
These people can't move. Right? And taxes always attach themselves to stable things more than mobile things. Because if you tax mobile things, people pick up and they move their business elsewhere. So what you look for is something that's impossible to move and then you really tax it. That people need it and then it's impossible to move and then you really tax that. When this goes away, it's going to be more flexible and mobile. Right? If Luxembourg suddenly says, we're going to start sharing Skype's revenue with the U.S., they'll move to the Cayman Islands. It doesn't matter where on the internet geographic location is removed as a site of taxation. So, yeah, at some point they'll be brought into the business network, but the characteristics that make the phone such a cash cow for the last 100 years are going to disappear in this world. And replacing the revenue is going to be a country-by-country problem. All right. So that was a longish comparison of networks and ties together, I think, a lot of the themes that we've been talking about so far. Decomposing networks into their parts, looking for the philosophical ramifications of the decomposition, and then seeing some effects of those, like the internet replacing the phone company. Yeah, right.
When you use your landline to connect to the internet, then the first part of your connection is a circuit switch network, right? When you call your local service provider, like a dial-up connection.
A dial-up connection, yes, a circuit switch.
What about DSL? Is the first part of the connection? Even in DSL, you have to dial up the number, right? Is the first part of that connection...
No, so DSL is a weird thing, because what DSL does is it runs over copper, but there's actually, right... There's a modulator demodulator at each end, but it's digital. A modulator demodulator modem.
Right.
That's where modem comes from. So you know you have to put those filters on your phone if you use DSL. That's because DSL is actually keeping the connection open all the time and just sending packets when you need it. So it's not the same as dial-up because there's always something listening at the other end. So it really is extending internet infrastructure. The DSL modem is essentially a router with one port. As opposed to a dial-up connection, which requires you to signal across the phone network.
So when you get a DSL connection, you get an IP address?
When you get a DSL connection, you get an IP address, yes. This box is given an IP address. You then put your own router on it if you want to do Wi-Fi at home. That uses something called DHCP, which provisions some temporary IP addresses. But yeah, to get DSL is to get an IP address. Same with the cable modem.
It's not a stable IP, though. It's its own dynamic.
It's some dynamic IP, but unlike the one provisioned from these boxes, it's globally unique and addressable. We'll get into that part, but yeah, it can vary as you connect and not connect, but it's a real IP address on the internet as opposed to being hidden behind network address transmission.
So every time you connect to the internet using DSL, you get a different IP?
You can get a different IP, yeah. In fact, there's no provision for getting the same one. All right, so a little exercise in thinking through network comparison issues. Here, in the drawing that I'm going to use next week, and we'll talk about here later.
A hopefully less geeky conversation.
I want to send this to myself, but it's too big. Right. What do I do?
Cut it up.
Packetize it. Right. So, we got the something unrelated to the addresses or routing, but completely related to the physical aspect of sending things through the mail. So, everybody, whip this up. Can you tear that little piece and pass that around? This is the physical version of what happens to an email message. Right? I create a message.
It gets cut up into packets. I forgot one critical piece. What piece did I forget? Before I take it apart, I need some way to know how to put it back together. How do I do that?
You need to number it.
So how am I going to number it?
Row and column.
You do row and column.
That's an obvious one. So, A1, A2, A3, A4, one, and if you can finish that. So, once we put headers on it,
right.
A1 through D5, 20 cards. Once we put headers on it, we're going to send each of these packets. And then, when it gets to me, I'm going to reassemble. This is a physicalized version of what happens to your email addresses. So what I want you to do when you get one of these cards, if you can rip up and start passing it right out. So I want you to put my address on it on the side with the scan. Post office delivers it to me, and I record the date that the card you sent me arrived. You don't have to put your name on the card, just say it. The other thing I want you to put in the corner is, how many days is it going to take before 50% of this message is delivered? How you can make that calculation? What do you need to know to guess about that number?
How far away the item is being sent from?
But you know that it's here and there. Right, we've got. What do you think? Look around. How reliable is this group? What are you considering when you want to guess the number of days?
What you know about the network you're going to be using.
And which networks are you going to be using?
There's two. Postal system and the.
Postal system and SneakerNet, right. SneakerNet is you. Right. So, the last days is the amount of time it takes for the residents of this room to get each of these messages into a post office box, plus the elapsed time it takes the post office to deliver it to my house. Skip Sunday. Pretend Sunday doesn't exist. So, what's the total? Mail delivery days are, six a week. Total number of days, right, for 50% of these messages to be delivered. When am I going to have the message half complete? What's the minimum that number could be? It's the same thought behind them. That's calendar days and elapsed days. We're going to call tomorrow day one. Right? So if you walked out of here and you put it in a post office box and the guy came by and he picked it up and drove to the post office and it got to my house, you get there tomorrow at 1. What's the maximum amount it could be? Because tonight's D&O and that's it. Right? It's going to get delivered by 9 o'clock right now. Right? So then there's something between, you're picking a number someplace between 1 and 50. Right?
I just want to ask you, do you think we're all raging alcoholics?
No, just you.
He said it.
Right, sorry. So you're picking a number someplace between 1 and infinity. Now, if this doesn't get delivered, if one of these doesn't get delivered, I don't get to put the whole message together. Right? How could I guarantee, without changing the reliability of either you or the post office, how could I improve the odds that I was going to get the message I needed?
Redundancy.
How would I do that?
Putting up set.
What's that? Mail a second set. That's right. So, but if someone's going to lose one, they're going to lose two, right?
When you different set.
There it is. So, right, one way to do this, right, let's imagine that it's A1 through B4, right, so that it's even. Right. I can do the exact same image, but do the numbering reverse, so that Sean gets both A1 messages, but they're different. That way, if neither of these gets delivered, I've got some redundancy. It's called forward error correction, right? Which is sending duplicate data to the system. There are many more elegant ways of doing it than repeating the entire amount of data 100%. But the basic principle is, if I've got an unreliable network, as I do, I have to add reliability at the edges. That's the smart network idea, right? To guarantee, or at least not to guarantee, to improve my chances of the whole message, 100% of the message being delivered, right? If there's an unreliable node delivering messages that loses the packets, but they're losing different packets, or different packets aren't being delivered, I still have a much better chance of getting the entire message than if I just send one. So, is that clear? So on that card, put my address, and then the elapsed number of days minus Sunday by which you think I will get half the message. You're going to pick a number someplace between 1 and infinity. Next week I'll put the outcomes. It's reading for next week. I'm sorry we didn't get to the reading for this week. There were more questions about phone and internet. We'll start. I'll start next week by making the points from this week's reading. We won't spend as much time on it. There is, in addition to that, a reading linked to the syllabus. It's Anthony Townsend's thesis. And I want you to read from that the intro and chapter 7. And that is about the changes that Anthony believes are coming in urban landscapes because of wirelessness. Next week, we set aside two classes of applications when we're talking about these networks. Set aside peer-to-peer and mobile telephony. Next week, I'll talk about those and how they're different from what we sketched out today. If you can hand me your papers, if you don't have them, if you can get them to me as quickly as possible. Of Anthony's thesis, and I'll put those instructions on.
How do you get a hold of the URL?
It's a joy. So,